From the Center for Contemporary South Asia at Brown University, this is Sensing the Sacred. I'm Finian Garrity. Welcome to Sensing the Sacred, where we delve into the past and present of religion, politics, and society in South Asia, highlighting the latest academic research through conversations with leading scholars. When you think of alcoholic drinks in world history, you might think of French wine, Japanese sake, Russian vodka. But what about India? Although it's not well represented in global histories of alcohol, in fact, Indian history overflows with drinking cultures and a diverse array of alcoholic drinks. Drink has been formative in Indian religion and society for a long time, as far back as a fermented grain beverage called Sirah in Vedic sacrifice some 2,500 years ago. In classical India, the Kama Sutra recommends that a lover offer drinks to his partner as a prelude to lovemaking. Religious texts forbid indulging in alcoholic drinks, warning against the sins of intoxication. Texts of traditional Indian medicine, Ayurveda, give recipes for a wide variety of medicines containing alcohol, as well as regimens to help patients handle their liquor better. And country drinks like palm wine, made from the fermented sap of coconut palms, have been drunk for centuries. We learn about all this, and more, through the pioneering research of James McHugh, professor of South Asian religions at the University of Southern California. His new book, An Unholy Brew, Alcohol in Indian History and Religions, is the first ever academic monograph on alcohol in early India. But it's not just about alcohol, because drinking in India was rarely an end in itself. Whether in rowdy festivals, sleepy taverns, or sophisticated salons, drinking was a social activity. Drinks were meant to be consumed with friends and snacks in a convivial atmosphere. By analyzing texts in Sanskrit, Pali, and Prakrit, McHugh offers insights on the technology of ancient brewing, theories of alcohol and intoxication, and how drink relates to other substances, including betel nut, cannabis, and tobacco. In this interview, he gives us a small taste of this rich scholarship. So pour yourself a glass and settle in. I started off by asking James about alcoholic drinks nowadays in contemporary India, where he's done quite a lot of traveling in search of drink. So I know that in doing research for this book, you examined regional traditions and sampled some local drinks. What was an especially memorable drink that you tried?
Ooh, that's interesting. Ones that I didn't really realize people were making so much anymore is these rice beers that you get made by indigenous Adivasi communities. There's various types of beer, like a drink like this. They're not quite beer, really. And I had the ones in Odisha and in West Bengal, and it's called Haria or Handia, which is actually named after the jar they make it in. And it's made in a way that's quite similar to something like sake. So you take rice and you inoculate steamed rice with, you kind of crumble these little balls of, they just look like a ball of white stuff, but they have herbs in and they have like various fungi in and bacteria and yeast in. They have like really, you know, there's research on all the flora in them, in fact. But what they manage to do when you inoculate with this stuff is the fungi turns the rice to the starch in the rice to sugar, and the yeast turns this sugar to alcohol. And there's, like I said, there's bacteria that add acids and flavors and all sorts of complicated things in there, and herbs as well. And it's just like a really cool drink. It's like this kind of milky colored, slightly ricey flavored, fresh, very mildly alcoholic drink. It's very similar, in fact, to some recipes you get for more ancient ones. And I was just really sort of pleasantly surprised to see people actually still make that style of drink. And what's interesting as well is that the method for making it, and the old ones as well, is this method using fungi to turn the starch to sugar, molds, which is what you get in Southeast Asia and East Asia. So it's almost like you have this kind of, if you sort of drew a map of brewing methods. It sort of, it partakes in a sort of pan-Asian, you know, fermentation style. I mean, you tend to think when you, if you're in a city in India, there'll be sort of like, you know, beer and whiskey and things like that. And it was cool to see that these rather archaic styles of drink were still being made, and made very well and very carefully, you know, with a lot of expertise.
Yeah. So interesting to hear the kind of echoes of the pre-modern, even in these contemporary experiences.
Mm, there's more of it around still than you'd think, in fact. That was a big take home. It's like, there's actually, I assumed a lot of this stuff had just disappeared that I've been reading about. And it, a lot of it kind of is still there in various shapes and forms, places, communities.
Well, let's turn then to the pre-modern, because early South Asia is the major focus of this book. So to begin, I wonder, I mean, if you could actually travel back in time and taste some of these drinks you've been reading about, maybe taste some kind of pre-modern Indian cocktail of your choice, what would it be?
I'd say there's three that I'd really like to taste.
Okay.
There's this one that was I read about that crops up in some Buddhist chants still. This one called Maireya or Maireya in Pali. And that seems to be very prestigious, kind of really quite early on, like, you know, kind of several centuries BCE. And that's like a double fermented drink. So like you'd make a sort of honey mead with some spices like black pepper and things like that. And then you'd ferment that. And then it seems that you basically sort of spike that with some jaggery, this sort of brown sugar type substance. And then you re-ferment it, which probably makes it stronger. And if you think, it doesn't have to be honey. It could be something like sugar cane juice. But imagine you use honey. You've got this kind of mead fermented till it's dry, say, with pepper and some of these sour, tangy herbs. And then you've got this second fermentation with brown sugar. And it would, you know, we'd have the honey, the sugar, the herbs, the spices. Be like really amazing. So that would be cool. And then there's a kind of sugar cane juice wine, it seems, that was big at 1.2. And I haven't really got recipes for that, but I would. They seem to have aged that. There's a few references to that being, you know, an aged version, having this beautiful color as well. So I'm kind of curious what this sort of aged one, like almost like this sort of weird sugarcane Madeira or something. And then, of course, these grain ones, which were a huge family of drinks. And, you know, actually the thing I had, this Hariya Handia stuff, is probably quite similar to the, say, some of the simpler versions of that. But they clearly made more complex ones that were made on a bigger scale and were probably also fermented for longer. And I'd be really curious to try those.
In your book, you make the point that scholarship on alcoholic drinks around the world has neglected South Asia. And you even suggest that maybe there's some conventional wisdom that South Asia lacks substantial traditions of alcoholic drinking. How does your research push back against this?
I don't sort of blame anyone studying it or writing about it, because there really just wasn't a ton of information out there. And the stuff that was out there was, you know, in rather obscure journals or very, very dense and sort of assumes, you know, like somebody knows loads of Sanskrit to understand these articles. So, but it's true, like if you just kind of like look around, just popular things on the history of alcohol, or they don't tend to get into the sort of South Asia historical context much. And there is this other parallel idea that you will find loads of stuff about cannabis or soma, the big mystery of what is soma and things like that. You will find a lot of, you know, writing about that. Popular, I mean, you can just find, you just go on the internet and start looking up soma. There'll be all sorts of like conspiracy theory, complicated stuff about it. People get really into it, and that's cool. It's really fascinating. I get that. But it's just actually, if from what I can tell, say, like, I don't know, say 2,000 years ago, I don't think anyone was sort of taking soma for fun, if you know what I mean. It was sort of this very ritualized context for a small number of people. And betel nut chewing hadn't appeared yet. People argue about the dating of cannabis. I don't see any evidence of people like using cannabis at that period. on a large scale. If people were in the business of getting intoxicated for pleasure 2,000 years ago, it seems like the substance was alcohol, really. And probably quite a lot of people did, prepare these various complicated, interesting forms of alcohol and enjoy them. And it's kind of weird that that's not the perception. You know, people think of Rome, they'll be like, wine, and things like that, Greece, wine. But when people think of sort of ancient India, they'll sort of, I don't know, they'll maybe sort of superimpose a sort of Sadhu with a chillum into the ancient past and maybe vaguely have some idea about Soma.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what these prototypical alcoholic drinks were in early South Asia, because it is wonderful how your book brings our attention to the fact that, yes, South Asia was an alcohol zone as well. You focus on a particular drink called sura, and you describe it as the prototypical drink of early India, the way wine might be characteristic or beer might be characteristic of certain, you know, regions of Europe in certain times. So what was sura? How was it made? Who drank it? And why did they drink it?
Yeah, I mean, the earliest references to alcoholic drinks we've got in surviving texts in the Vedas mention sura, and we have slightly later than the very earliest Vedas, we have some texts describing it, and it's a grain drink there, made from grains. But if you think, if you've really basically got one type of drink, say it's called sura, sura doesn't just mean that, it also just is your word for liquor, generally, for any kind of alcoholic drink. So sura... One, it does seem that the earliest versions that we know of, at least, you know, we've not got the whole picture, obviously. But it seems the earliest versions were some sort of grain thing. But at the same time, that word and the kind of concept sort of does dominate a lot of discussions, legal, medical. It's you know, so sometimes you'll read about sura, they just mean sort of alcoholic drinks. And sometimes it's more specifically, you know, grain drinks.
Yeah, I take your point, because it's one you elaborate on in the book, that some of these terms like sura both can refer to specific drinks in specific contexts, but then also can be these catch-all terms for a kind of class of drink. I guess it's kind of like the way beer or wine or spirits, right, can refer either to a specific drink in context or to this any of a wide range of beverages.
I mean, there's quite a lot of parallels like that. I mean, I always think the way people use wine, you know, if you say wine, want a glass of wine, tends to mean grape wine, or, you know, but then, you know, you will hear people talking about rice wine or palm wine, or, and then people in England make all these fruit wines, like, you know, sort of blackberry wine and things like that. And then there's a, I mentioned that in the book somewhere, there's a, you know, it's a very, very strong type of beer you get in England that people call barley wine because it's particularly strong. So many of the words for these drinks have that kind of complexity going on, which was actually quite, which meant sort of getting to the bottom of like what they were and how to even understand a word in a given context, like a legal or ritual or medical one, is tricky because, you know, are they using a very general sense of the word or specific? And, you know, I'm not always completely confident I got it right, to be honest, but, you know, it's like, you know, it's good to be aware of that.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because it probably is worth emphasizing that your main method for constructing this history of alcohol in South Asia is a close reading of ancient texts, a lot of times in Sanskrit, but then other Indic languages as well. But then there's this other part of your method that we've already talked a little bit about, in terms of, you know, field work, trying to see how people make alcohol today. And then also this approach of imaginatively reconstructing, you might say, alcoholic drinks from ancient recipes and clues that you find in old texts. And actually, a couple years back, I was lucky enough to sample some sura that was based on a Vedic recipe, I believe, that you made with a local brewer in Massachusetts. You've described the flavor pretty well when you're talking about some of these other grain drinks, but it was kind of malty and a little bit sweet, very cloudy, you know, it had a lovely taste, but quite a contrast from like your typical like New England IPAs that they were serving in that brewery. But can you say something more about this experiential approach where you try to reconstruct drinks based on ancient recipes?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically it's pretty similar to what people do in things like experimental archaeology, which is a very long established thing of like, oh, let's study iron making and then experiment with, you know, primitive forms of iron making, and then we'll understand what we find, you know, what we find when we dig things up. So it's kind of similar to that. And one thing in particular is that a lot of sort of more well-known modern Western ways of making alcoholic drinks, say the way they'd make beer in England or America a lot of the time, or winemaking, or even modern sake making, is if you just have that in your mind as a model for how to make alcohol, and not only that, not just the actual method, but the way the stages and substances are understood, people would believe now we are adding yeast. You know, the way the kind of concepts attached to the parts of the process. If you just have that in your head and you go and look at all these old recipes, you're just going to get hopelessly confused. There'll be something involved that maybe scientists don't think really serves much fermentation purpose. But for the people who make it, there's this bit that you have to prepare with like toasting grains or something, and it's seen as absolutely essential to do it. And you know, like some people do introduce this sort of rational scientific understanding of the process, might be like, well, why are they doing that? You know what I mean? What does that add to it? But you know, if you can kind of just let go of that a bit as well, I mean, I do think about those aspects as well, but if you can kind of get used to these other methods and also not just reading about them but observing different ones, you end up with this very, very open mind about styles of fermentation. And then when you turn to these old recipes and other data that maybe hints, if not just recipes, but sort of allusions to the process, then you have had a much better chance of making sense of them. And so I feel relatively confident that having done all that, that the... I think I have managed to get it right, more or less, if you know what I mean. But like if I said, if all I knew about was German beer brewing, I would never have understood it. It would have just seemed very baffling.
Yeah. From the book, I can tell that when you talk about these recipes in the ancient context or in the pre-modern context, they're not recipes like we might expect to find in a cookbook, like, you know, a half a teaspoon of this, like with very exact instructions.
Yeah, they vary, the recipes. And you've got to bear in mind, like, they're all, the reason people wrote recipes down in the ancient world is not often the same as the reasons we write recipes down. And there's different contexts. So, you know, I've got some recipes for, if we call them recipes at all, you know, there's some descriptions of how to make a grain syrah. They're in a ritual text, a Vedic ritual text. You know, you're not really making this to drink for fun. You're making it for ritual means. And it's probably very, it might not even be quite what people are doing that make beer for fun in that society. It's almost a bit like, you know, if you think of like a Catholic mass, you know, you do pour out a drink and have it, you know what I mean? But it's not exactly the same as going to someone's house for a glass of wine. Yeah. You know, it's become very so, but at the same time, it probably, you're adding water, which is a bit of a sort of, you know, Roman thing to do. And so that recipe probably has all sorts of funny artifice like that going on. And then I've got others that do give exact quantities, but they don't give the method. And they're from texts on sort of the Artashastra and sort of economics. And the reason they're giving those recipes is probably to have sort of standardized, you know, sort of state regulated quantities and quality controls and taxation and things like that. So they don't give the method, you know what I mean? And then you'll have medical texts and they'll just be like, this thing is made of whatever. And they don't give quantities or method. Some do, but you'll have ones that just go, you know, they'll give you the name of the drink and go, that is made from barley and whatever. And it's like, that's it.
Well, as you know, I study Vedic texts, so you'll forgive me for dwelling a little bit on some of this Vedic material and the Vedic uses of syrah. But I'm curious because, you know, you've made the point that it was central to certain Vedic rites, and this is the domain of Brahmins, who are the priestly class, who otherwise do not drink. So can you reflect on this a little more? Is there any ambivalence around the use of alcohol in Brahminical contexts or in religious contexts more broadly?
Yeah, in that very ancient context, they brew and use sudar in one ritual, this Sautramani, right? I'm not going to get into the details of the ritual, but you know, it's seen in the long term, in both within sort of Hindu traditions and outside, it's seen as kind of anomalous and sort of strange that, like, what? Like, you know, like, you're offering that in a Vedic rite. And then actually, even within the tradition, though, because there's after you've made this stuff and offered it, it's like, what do you do? You know, how do you get rid of the rest of it? And there are sometimes, you know, the priests are meant to drink it. But then there's clearly massive discomfort with that from quite an early period. It's like you can give it to another community to drink, or you can pour it somewhere. And so it seems people were uncomfortable. But that's the sort of really ancient period. From pretty early on, whether it's like sort of more Brahminical or Hindu texts, or Buddhist or Jain, there is this idea that people who are living a very sort of self-controlled life of some sort, ascetics or just, you know, strict Brahmins, there's a sort of general idea that they shouldn't drink, kind of across the board. There's that sort of general idea that you just sort of find in early sources of kind of everywhere. And but then the way it's sort of over history and interpretation and expansion of things, it kind of gets given a bit more of a, say, Jain spin or a Buddhist spin. And in the Hindu context, it becomes sort of a very defining feature of sort of Brahmin Varna, and to a certain extent also Kshatriya and Vaishya, but less strictly so. And it is related to the whole sort of, like, you know, you have the Vedas, you can, if you have the Vedas in your body, you can't put this stuff in your body and stuff like that. So it gets a kind of Vedic flavor, the prohibition as things develop.
Well, if we look beyond the Veda to the later history of alcohol, one of my favorite parts of your book was the way you reconstructed and described passages about a special Surah house, a kind of roadside bar or something like that. I don't know what a good modern equivalent would be. But can you tell me what a visit to the Surah house would have been like?
Yeah, that was actually fun doing that. So the most detailed description of a kind of Surah house was in the Artashastra, and I was working with Patrick Olivelle's really good work and translation on that. But there's other references to them. There's quite a lot of references in things like Pali Jataka prose sections and elsewhere as well. And so it seems these things varied from, like, a real simple little place to quite a sophisticated, you know, drinking house that was sort of big and lucrative and complex. It seems they brewed their own stuff. So they were sort of a brewery and a shop, if you know what I mean, at the same time. And they probably didn't have a huge range of things on offer. It was the only shop in the ancient period that had a sign. And they talk about these signs, these banners. It's not clear what that was until, you know, there's hints of it in one later legal text, which says it's like a jar. Probably maybe like a jar on a stick or a pole. And so, you know, it would be a building in town that would have some kind of sign that indicated it was the Surah place. You'd go in. It seems people sat in there. They brewed in there. They had jars in there with the stuff in. And a big part, an essential part of all drinking, mentioned in, I think, almost all texts from over the long period, is you have these sort of various spicy, salty snacks as well, which could vary from just, like, you know, say, boiled chickpeas with, like, black pepper and fresh ginger, to maybe more things like sort of fish and stuff like that, sort of spicy. So I think you'd go in there, you'd buy your bowl, fully your bowl of drink, whatever it was. They'd ladle it out for you, and you'd, you know, sit there with your friends and get some salty snacks. And I mean, it's not a million miles off, say, if you go to a traditional toddy shop in Kerala, or even these sort of country liquor places you get all over this sort of, there's two, you know, there's sort of two big divisions of alcohol in India. There's the Indian manufactured foreign liquor and Indian manufactured Indian liquor, so country liquor, which just tends to be like this kind of like plain spirit. Sometimes it's flavored. They have like sort of orange flavor and things like that. But those places, you know, they don't have a huge range of drinks, and they also have tons of these really interesting salty snacks. So yeah, so you go into this bar, you pay for your drinks, maybe hints that people sometimes ran up debts and were getting drink on credit, and you'd sit. I think people sat there. There's references to people sort of singing and dancing and sort of getting really wasted and sort of like, you know, dancing, sort of pulling half the clothes off and eating snacks. And yeah, I mean, in a way, it's not that different from quite a lot of places today. Yeah.
So I'm gathering that the prototypical Indian drinks that you've discussed so far were all made by fermentation.
Yeah.
Combining grains with other ingredients and then basically letting time and nature run its course. But obviously, from a contemporary perspective, we're familiar with other ways of making alcohol. Distillation would be the most familiar. And your book draws attention to debates around distillation in the history of alcohol in early South Asia. So what is distillation exactly? And can you set the record straight? How old do you think this technology really is in the South Asian context?
Yeah, it's strange that whole question is probably one of the more controversial aspects of this. It's not what you'd have thought just sort of going into it. So they made, people made drinks. You can start with the starch like rice or wheat, but then you've got to turn that into sugar before you ferment it, the sugar to alcohol. Or you can start with just sugar, like sugar cane juice. So already there's two main divisions, and one's kind of simpler. If you think something like, well, palm sap, just, you don't have to do anything to it. It just kind of changes on its own. So there's that thing. And then like that's sort of stage one of making, you know, alcohol, making an alcoholic drink. But it won't get very strong. It's never going to get very strong doing that. So, you know, with distillation, you have to heat the drink and the alcohol evaporates at different rates to the other parts of the drink, like the water and other components, sugars that are hanging around in there, things like that. And not everything evaporates, obviously. So if you heat it, you know, and you catch that vapor and you cool that vapor and condense it, that condensed vapor will be stronger than the alcoholic drink. And, you know, if you do it very carefully, you can kind of shave bits off the first vapors and the last vapors, and you can do it several times and you can get really strong, you know, you can get really strong distilled drinks. So, you know, like you sort of distill wine, you're going to get brandy or something like that. You've got to think, though, like, I mean, one thing is, like, why bother distilling? You know, like, so if somebody's, like, making a load of beer and, like, I'm making beer for my village and everyone, I make my beer, they drink it and they sell my beer. I make money out of that. Why are you going to, it's just like, what's the advantage in getting all this equipment? You've got to really think with distillation is like, what's the sort of economic or practical advantage? And, you know, there's things like, well, one, it's stronger. So that might be sort of a luxurious, cool thing, sort of like a more sort of exciting drug. Or it might be easier to trade. It might store better as well because some things might be perishable. But, you know, there's quite a lot of context where you just don't need to bother with that. Because, like, you know, I make this stuff, I sell it. So that's just a sort of background thing. You've always got to think, you know, why on earth would anybody be bothering distilling stuff anyway? Anyhow, so there's this, then this debate, there's, and you'll see this in some Indian museums, this kind of apparatus with, you know, made of kind of clay pots and various shaped vessels and things, presented as ancient distillation technology. And this comes from, yeah, this John Marshall guy, excavating this site called Takshila, and he found he had a couple of vessels he sort of didn't know what to do with. He was like, I don't know what these are for, because, you know, he was like trying to say, oh, this is a sieve and this is a whatever, you know, water jar and things like that. And so he found some and he was like, I don't really know what that is. And so what he did is he kind of said, well, these are the ones, and if you put them all together, it looks like the sort of equipment they use nowadays, kind of round here, wherever he was, you know, like near Tashilin. If you assemble these bits, it looks like distillation equipment. So I think maybe that, you know, answers the question as to what these mystery vessels were for. But the things to bear in mind is the bits he brought together to sort of make this, he didn't dig up all this stuff, like all sort of crushed together in one spot with like loads of ash. And, you know, he didn't do that at all. He found a couple of things that didn't make sense and then sort of cherry picked other vessels from around the site and made this apparatus and did a very famous illustration of it, which kind of, you know, caught on, as you know, and people do the same, you know, reconstruction with the same vessels in various museums, and it gets in textbooks, this illustration. But the thing is, the texts don't mention distillation at all. I mean, this is a bit complicated because some of the Sanskrit vocabulary involved with alcohol making in later Sanskrit texts probably does refer to distillation. So, you know, it's just a bit like, that's kind of, you know, complicated and rather messy too. But so you end up with this idea that, like, you know, distillation, alcoholic distillation was invented in South Asia and they had it. But it's frankly, we have quite clear descriptions of how they did make alcoholic drinks. It didn't involve distillation. But then distillation does seem to appear. You do get references to it from about the 12th century of the Common Era. And the thing is, when it appears, they do talk about it. They have specific vocab, quite clear descriptions of it. And so when it appears, it's pretty clear they're talking about it. So it seems it appears then. Now, obviously, I'm sure people were fiddling about heating liquids and dealing with condensates forever, if you know what I mean. So it's not to say that somebody, you know, when people talk about who discovered distillation, it's just like, well, I don't know, the first time anyone ever noticed that, like, a boiling pot of water with a lid on has stuff on the inside of the lid, and maybe the, you know, you're boiling salty water, the water on the lid isn't salty. You've discovered distillation. So it's kind of, and people were probably doing that for various things, and maybe with, like, all sorts of medicines and stuff for ages. So I'm not saying they weren't distilling in India, or maybe couldn't have been discovered in the region. But, like, you know, large-scale distillation of alcoholic drinks to make some sort of brandy-type, whiskey-type stuff, I think that didn't really get going until about the 12th century. But this one of these things, because it's in so many museums and textbooks, I think people might be like, "You what? You know, that's I've ever since I was a child, I've just taken it for granted that distillation was invented in India." You know what I mean? So,
well, we've been talking about these homegrown Indian techniques, and I want to keep on talking about that in a few minutes. But first, I'm curious to know about imported alcohol. Is there any evidence for importation of alcohol? I'm thinking of wine in particular.
Yeah, so most of these things were homegrown. And I mean, one thing to emphasize there is, as well as we talked a lot about the grain things, but, like, you know, South Asia, at a very early period, had domesticated sugarcane and a whole very impressive range of ways of processing sugarcane, you know, into juice, various cooked, purified things, various crystal sugars and syrups. And, you know, there's lots of words for that. And they also had, you know, various other sources of sugar, fruits, and this is maduka, mawa, tree, this nectar, people use honey as well. So one thing to bear in mind is, like, within South Asia, like, one, you know, say by about 1500 years ago, there was a lot of options for drinks and many different types of drinks. So it's a very varied world. But yeah, most of it was made locally. Might have been moved around a bit, you know, like, say, maybe, like, I don't know, some sort of posh honey sugar spice thing might have been worth trading. But yeah, the main import was wine. And there's references, textual references, and there's archaeological material for that as well. And wine was imported from regions that are good for growing grapes because of the climate. And also, not just for growing grapes, but you also, you know, if it's really stonkingly crazy hot, it's not great for actually making wine as well. You know, you don't have sort of air-conditioned warehouses in those days, you know what I mean? So you want, like, good wine-growing regions and good sort of, you know, vinification, sort of wine-making region as well. So it seems that some of this wine came from parts of sort of modern Afghanistan. And then also we have archaeological materials from the sort of Middle East. And there's later references to sort of early modern references to it coming from parts of Iran, like Shirazi wine. And also there's archaeological materials from the Mediterranean. I mean, it's not always 100% certain what was in these jars. But I think, you know, some, you know, really good archaeologists are pretty confident that it was wine. So you'd have stuff coming from Italy, and you would also have stuff coming from maybe parts of Iran or, you know, where they were growing grapes. And then up more inland from the north, as it were. And also maybe, who's to say as well, you know, people might have been importing raisins and making their own wine. So you could probably, and I've seen this in Ayurvedic factories, so you'll get a load of raisins that maybe came from modern Afghanistan. And you'll soak the raisins overnight, and then you'll sort of rub them through a sieve and mix that with water and jaggery, this brown sugar type substance, and ferment that. I think wine was, in a lot of parts of, you know, South Asia, wine was largely an import. And if you just think, we don't know the price, but if you've got to imagine, like, you know, Mrs. So-and-so's, you know, millet beer from the local millet in the fields over there, made in a clay jar by Mrs. So-and-so that doesn't keep very long, but it's nice. If you think the price of a glass of that versus... And these, actually, the jars that kind of came from modern Iran kind of area, these ones, they're called torpedo jars, and they're like, they're huge, they're like massive. They're sort of like amphoras, but they're more sort of torpedo shaped. They're like big, so you've got to imagine, like, this stuff has to go all, overland, you know, where it's made, get on a ship, get taken all over, you know, and the people are probably paying duty on it in various places, trading it, you know, paying for the shipping and things like that. And then somebody has to take it at the port of arrival and carry it on carts sort of inland to whatever city you're in India to drink it. And you can imagine the price of that compared to the sorghum beer will be very different. So I do get hints in some of the texts that, you know, grape wine was kind of a more sort of posh and prestigious drink, in fact.
So another part of your book that I really love is that you're ranging so widely over different genres of text, erotic, medical, literary. And by culling passages from these texts, you bring out these details that kind of contribute to an anthropology of drinking in South Asia, how people drank in private, in public, in between. And I'm thinking specifically of drinking in high society, which you term luxurious, erotic drinking. Can you set the scene? How does alcohol shape these erotic encounters in elite circles?
Yeah, I mean, we talked a lot about the ingredients, but if you think with drinks, I was just alluding that with the sort of wine being posh, but if you think, like, even within wine, you know, champagne, it's like wedding toasts, it's, you know, it has a, you use it, it's a specific substance, and it's expensive for a good reason, champagne, because it's like a total pain to make. But it also, you know, whether it's a, also if you think whether it's in a movie, champagne, or it's just a picture of champagne, it has all sorts of connotations and uses. And so that was something I tried to reconstruct. And that's why I did this very, very wide-ranging thing of looking at all sorts of contexts to kind of triangulate in on getting a little bit of a sense of what the drinks meant to people, or how drinking was conducted. One of the styles of drinking you get represented is in literary texts, and literary texts is very artificial and full of conventions, is this drinking in private by wealthy people, often couples. Now, it's hard to know if this ever happened, but so many texts, and not just literary ones, you get it in the Kama Sutra, you get it in more narrative texts. You know, this is one of these methodological things, is like, how skeptical are you going to be? But I mean, yeah, I feel like some people are like, no, like, all this ancient Indian stuff, it's just pure convention. It gives absolutely no insights into any kind of social reality whatsoever. I'm actually completely sympathetic to that point of view, but I feel like you can take it a bit far. It's just like, well, okay, then basically all of this stuff is 100% completely artificial. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm a bit skeptical about that. Basically, drink was quite closely associated with sort of erotic encounters. So, and this is mentioned in the Kama Sutra, that it's kind of the prelude to lovemaking. You kind of, everyone has a few drinks, and they have a few drinks together, and then they make love, and then they have a few drinks after. And you have visual scenes of couples drinking as well, like kind of quite a lot of art with that. And yeah, so it seems that the drink was a kind of prelude, and it was a kind of post-coital cigarette type thing as well. And this would be in private. You would have snacks, at least after. And you might also chew betel in a pan as well afterwards, or maybe before, because it sort of perfumes your mouth. What's interesting is, if you think, a lot of rich people, and this actually applies to tea drinking in the West as well, a lot of rich people, they would have stuff served to them, like, you know, the food would be served to them, put on their plate, or maybe the drinks would be poured for them. Whereas in this context, you serve each other. So like the man would kind of give the cup to the woman to drink, and then actually often they drink out of each other's mouths. And there's a similar thing that was notable. French people, like posh French people in like the sort of 18th century, noticed the tea, they call it the sort of service à l'anglaise, sort of English service. Because, you know, and actually if you watch some sort of TV show like The Crown, it's very notable the Queen does this as well, that like, it's kind of very significant in that kind of context that, you know, the Queen will actually pour out the tea for you. It's like, normally, Queen does not do shit like, you go to a banquet in the Buckingham Palace, the Queen doesn't sort of wander around with a, you know, silver service platter and sort of like put it on your plate. But with tea, it's this English service you do. And this kind of private drinking has that factor that you send the servants out of the room, and then you kind of give each other drink as and then you make love, and then you give each other snacks and drink, you feed each other stuff after, and it's very sort of intimate, this kind of feeding each other.
So women obviously play a prominent role in these trysts. But what about elsewhere? Is the drinking world a man's world in South Asia? How do women figure in this history?
Yeah, that's kind of hard to get at, because often when the genderedness of drinking is emphasized, it will be in a sort of poetic context that's trying to be all romantic and delightful. So they're going to highlight the genderedness there because it's that kind of scene. And then in other materials where we'll have descriptions of, say, you know, a surah shack, if there's women involved there, it might well be a moral tale. And these women are disreputable and sinful and need to be disapproved of. So it's a kind of moral tale. So yet again, that's kind of, you know, this is where the sort of skepticism about accessing any social reality through the text is kind of quite valid. Nevertheless, I mean, I do feel like, you know, there's a lot of references in various texts to women brewers, and you do have references to women drinking in the sort of social gatherings, as well as these private settings. There's an image at a janta, which some scholars believe might is this wheel of samsara, this sort of samsara chakra thing, and it's the asura realm. And for complicated mythological reasons in Buddhism, asuras are associated with drinking, sort of anti-gods, as it were, the asuras. And in that, there is this image which does, you know, seem to have some kind of shop where someone's ladling out a drink and people are standing on the street drinking it. And I think it is quite likely that I agree that it probably is Sudar shop, so we have a visual image of that. And the drinkers are women there, and it's the seller is a man and his wife, and there seem to be sort of bowls of food as well, which would fit. It's quite likely that women both were involved with brewing and selling, and also drinking as well.
I want to make sure that we talk about being drunk during this conversation. So how is drunkenness conceived in early India?
Well, some texts very much frown on it, and they emphasize the confusion. Well, even the ones that like it emphasize the confusion. It's, if anything, you know, you confuse stuff. Things spin around for you visually. There's a lot of emphasis on visual confusion or visual transformations, like everything moves, everything spins. But you get confused. You might try and kiss the wrong person or mistake one thing for another. So there's a general sense of confusion. It makes people chatty, makes them uninhibited, it makes them sing, dance, makes them erotically aroused. So this can all be good, you know what I mean? This can be seen as a kind of good thing. It kind of gets the party going, or it gets the couple going, or it gets the sort of uptight young man enjoying himself finally. So that can be good, but it can also be really bad, because you can, like, you know, you can sort of get too familiar with your boss. You can disclose secrets. There's quite a few references to people taking their clothes off. You know, there's like to naked drunks. You get it in a kind of sexy way or in a humorous way, where people are sort of like the clothes are falling off and they're lifting them up and dancing around. But you also get like references to, you know, the sort of shameful humiliatingness of, you know, falling asleep naked on the gutter, drunk and things like that. So, so it's a mixed bag, drunkenness. It depends on the situation, depends who you're with. The thing is, like, drinking was always social. So there's very, you know, there's all these different drinks. Some people don't drink. You always have drink with snacks. There's posh drinks, poor drinks. There's public drinking in bars. There's private drinking, you know, with your partner. But it's always social. The drunkenness is connected to that. So are you drinking with your lover in private? Then you can probably get like really drunk, it's fine, you know what I mean? Because like it's kind of a safe space for drunkenness. Are you sort of with your friends and you're of a class who's permitted to drink? You're with some friends, you know, you're in a bar where, you know, the only other people are going to see you are the other people in the bar. So that's cool if you make a fool of yourself.
Yeah. Well, thinking about these scenes of drunkenness, which I'm sure a lot of contemporary listeners could relate to on some level, makes me wonder about the moral cast of these discussions. Is alcohol considered a vice?
Yeah, it varies. Like I said, the morality of it is super complicated. It's not at all, you know, even within one tradition, it's not just like drink is bad. There are obviously loads of statements that just say drink is bad, but when you kind of get into the fine details of, say, Hindu law, it's related to the sort of Varna system, and different drinks as well are treated in different ways. And then there's like multiple explanations given for why it's bad. And Jainism, they have a thing in Jainism about how, well, one, it makes you do stupid stuff, but also when you ferment a drink, loads of little living beings kind of come to originate in the liquid. So by drinking it, you're murdering all these, you're like killing. So it's actually a form of violence, drinking. So all the different moralities have a different take on it. As for a vice, there's a kind of very well-developed way of sort of talking about it for kings. And kings would typically be permitted to drink legally, but there's an idea that they have to do it in moderation. So you get these kind of lists, and they kind of go way back, these lists. They're kind of ancient, and there's kind of similar groupings of behaviors, if not the exact same list, in the epics and all sorts of contexts. And so these vices would be for kings, so it's a man, would be, you know, drinking, hunting, overindulgence in sex with women, and gosh, what's the other vice?
Gambling.
Gambling, of course. I can forget gambling. So, but you know, kings do indulge in those, but they just not to let it get out of control. But that's very much aimed at kings, that vice idea. But there is also, there are general, you know, there are sort of general blanket statements about, you know, drinking is the way, you know, is the way of the world, but ideally you're better off not doing it and things like that. So, so there is, and that will be addressed to everyone. That's nothing to do with caste or being a monk or anything like that, or a king. That some of those statements are just general, you know, proverbial wisdom about don't do it. It's really, you'll do stupid stuff. You'll ruin your family. You'll spend all your money. You'll, everyone will see you telling all your innermost secrets naked in the gutter with a dog pissing in your mouth.
Well, to shift gears a little bit, I think most people would not think about going to the doctor to get some alcohol or to get an alcoholic preparation. But you show that there is some role for alcoholic medicines, we might say, in traditional Indian medicine, in Ayurveda. So what do Ayurvedic texts contribute to our understanding of the history of alcohol?
Yeah, so there's multiple ways. Well, one, they refer, we've got really quite old Ayurvedic texts, so they're quite good for, you know, tracking the history of different drinks and what they're made of and how they were made. So that's one thing. And they'll be, because things like just the drinks people drank for fun have, you know, pharmacological properties in Ayurveda. But there's also a whole load of recipes. There's a whole category of Ayurvedic medicine, which is sort of fermented preparations. And they're, especially these ones called Arishtas, and Asavas, but in the early period, the sort of 100% medicinal one that would be the Arishta. And they're, you know, they wouldn't be drunk for fun. You know, they're full of all sorts of complicated herbs and they have, you know. So that's, you know, so there's a whole class of medicines that are fermented. But then Ayurvedic texts also deal with the medical problems that can arise from drinking. And also, like with food, how to, you know, like just like Ayurvedic texts sort of explain how to eat for health. They're not all about like bad food. They're also kind of a positive instructions on good eating. So Ayurvedic texts have, you know, positive instructions on healthy drinking and also on dealing with bad drinking. And so and they're clear. They make it clear that, you know, this only applies to people who can drink. They also tend to say this applies to wealthy people who can afford to have this very complicated regime of drinking, perhaps even organized for you by a doctor who will sort of tell you how what to drink and when in what season with what snacks. So it's not everyone can afford to do that. So that's the thing I thought was interesting. I can't imagine going, you see, like nowadays, like in my sort of middle age, drink really messes with my sleep.
Yeah.
I went to my doctor and maybe it's naive because I've been sort of reading Ayurveda, but I was like, oh, well, drink really messes. Hey, doctor, my doctor's great. I love her. She's fabulous. But I was like, drink really messes with my sleep. Can you help me with this? And then, and you know, obviously the reply is like, just don't drink then. You know what I mean? As opposed to, actually, yes, we have this special medication that enables you to carry on drinking and get a good night's sleep. But basically, Ayurveda, classical Ayurveda, would have that. You know, if drinking is sort of not working for you, it's kind of making you feel crappy, they'd be like, ah, oh, well, you need to stop drinking this drink. You need to drink something made of sugarcane instead. And you should maybe have these herbs with it and these types of snacks with it. And then drinking will be okay again. So the sort of positive, positive dietetics of drinking in Ayurveda is one of the things it does is it helps you to drink, get back to drinking being nice for you, which is like sort of inconceivable in sort of modern American drinking. Though this could be a huge gap in the market, in fact, for somebody to solve. And but then they also deal with like drinking gone wrong where it makes you really sick and you can get really sick, but it's not really alcoholism. It's not like an addiction. It's not like somebody's like compulsively drinking huge amounts and this is like, you know, like, and they can't stop and this is like, you know, it's not alcoholism. It's very similar to other things in Ayurveda. The problems of where drinking makes you ill have various manifestations. They're to do with your own complex web of factors, your own constitution, what you've been eating, what you've been drinking, maybe things like the weather, the climate, the you know, all sorts of things. And so the way to treat the sort of disorder that arises from intoxication isn't to be like, you will never have a drink again in Ayurveda. It's like, oh, we just need to work out where you were drinking, what was going wrong with your drinking. And so they go, ah, right, so this was going wrong with your drinking. Now, instead, you've got to start drinking. You actually cure it with the right drink. So you basically cure it by giving the right drink and the, you know, the right food and the right the other, you know, some medicine, various treatments and things like that. And this might not, this is classical Ayurveda. I'm sure obviously modern Ayurveda has a different take on it.
You mentioned alcoholism. Is there evidence for alcoholism more broadly in early India, that it was a concern of folks who wrote these texts?
It's hard to say. I mean, the thing is, this is one of those things, is like, how do you translate some of these words? And some people have for a long time been translating them as alcoholism. So you'll pick up translations and they'll say things like alcoholic or alcoholism. So you might be like, well, yeah, it says it in that book. You know what I mean? But that's, you know, that's kind of added to the translation. Somebody translating that into English 400 years ago would not have said alcoholism, because there wasn't that concept in English at that point. So it's tricky. So you definitely have people who are very, very attached, like with these vices, like people are very attached to gambling. You know, they kind of like really, really enjoy it, and they do it excessively, and they keep going back to it, whether it's gambling or sex or hunting or, you know, drinking. So you do have this sense that it can be sort of ruinous, and it can be ruinous to your health and your, you know, your finances. And also, you know, just generally your balance of life priorities, people that drink too much. It's not necessarily that the people drink too much that it's just like they're sort of destroying their liver or something like that. It tends to be a whole range of things, of like they're always drunk, they're always doing stupid stuff, they're neglecting their job, they're neglecting their family, they're wasting money on it, they're hanging around with like dumb people.
Well, as my final question, I want to step back a little bit and think about this book in terms of your larger research agenda. Your first book was on the history of smell in South Asia, a topic that you dealt with in your dissertation. So does all of this cultural and material history connect in some way? What inspired you to turn to the history of alcohol?
It's a bit weird with me, because I kind of got into studying Sanskrit and things through being interested in Indian philosophy. But then I was also really like, when I was like, you know, like at high school and things, I was kind of more interested in things like chemistry and biology in a way than the humanities. I was never like a big bookish person. So it's almost like I managed to sort of, you know, I started learning Sanskrit, and then I realized that there were various things that you'd either read about, or you might actually be in India in a temple and see going on. You'd be like, well, what's going on with that? You know what I mean? And some of these things hadn't received much attention. And then when I started studying that kind of stuff to do with like recipes or the properties of substances or the cultural meaning of sandalwood or alcohol or betel nut chewing, you know, palm chewing, I feel like it kind of scratched that, you know, chemist, biologist itch as well. So I kind of get to sort of like, you know, think about stuff, and as well as doing the sort of historical textual work. And then I must admit I do like the side of this method of the almost like the experimental archaeology. So say with the perfume project, you know what I mean, it was genuinely useful to go and spend a lot of time in, say, South Indian garland markets, which is just some of the most amazing places in the universe, like a South Indian whole row of stalls selling different types of jasmine is genuinely one of the most amazing olfactory things ever in the world today.
Yeah, well, as we're sitting here talking, I can see your lovely garden in the background. And I know that you're a gardener as well, and you spend time with roses and cultivating other plants. But is there a way that your gardening kind of inspires your scholarship in some way? Is there a connection there?
I guess a bit. I mean, I do tend to try and grow some. Actually, I'm not growing anything super ancient here, but you know, I am growing some roses that you would get in India more recently than. And I just grew some tobacco out because I'm interested in tobacco and things like that. So, and tobacco is not really in the text that I've been, it's some very late ones it is mentioned. But yeah, I mean, I guess there is an element with the gardening as well of dabbling in spending time getting to know the process of growing and processing plants that have economic, with the tobacco it's actually a real pain. In fact, I've been trying to work out, and there's loads of YouTube videos on it, but I've been trying to cure some of the leaves. But, you know, you've got to pick them at the right time, you've got to dry them to the right stage, then you've got to, like, stop them going moldy, but then you've got to ferment them. It's actually really difficult. And, but, you know, that gives you a real feel for, oh, that's how tobacco works. And that would, yeah, again, that would be useful it's just like these tobacco, there is a Sanskrit, you know, there are Sanskrit medical texts that talk about tobacco when it appears. And one of them says, you know, it's got lots of flowers and it's got many seeds. And then, like, when you grow tobacco and each flower produces this little sort of pod, sort of shaped a bit like about as big as a peanut, sort of oval thing. And when they dry and you crack them open, just one of those has, like, must have, like, about 2,000 microscopic seeds in, and then like the whole plant has like about like 200 of those little pods, and you're like, this must be like thousands. So like then you're like, oh yeah, that Sanskrit text that said it is many seeded, you're like, two white tobacco is many seeded. I could, you're not exaggerating. So you know, it's always a bit useful. Yeah.
Well, James, thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation, and congratulations on this really impressive book. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. It was great to chat and share it with everyone.
This episode of Sensing the Sacred was produced by me, Finian Garrity. We'll be back soon with a new conversation. In the meantime, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a review, or recommend us to your friends and colleagues. To learn more about Sensing the Sacred and James McHugh's new book, An Unholy Brew, visit our website. We'll put links in the show notes. Thanks for listening.